All right, so tonight we are again looking at the book of Acts. Now we've moved up through the first 11 chapters, and now we move into chapter 12. Chapter 12 kind of is the end of the first half of the book. The focus will change slightly in several different ways. Number one, the focus of evangelism takes more of a Gentile focus. And then also, it will become a lot more focused on Paul rather than Peter as we continue from this point forward. In chapter 12, we will see the killing of the Apostle James, and Peter is imprisoned, as well as the death of Herod. And so in our last study, as we do a quick review of that, we discussed how Barnabas brought Saul into the work from Tarsus, into the work in Antioch. And there, they're with the Christians for a year, working and together. And so that's kind of where we leave them. We leave them taking the benevolence from Antioch and traveling down to Jerusalem to bring that benevolent offering as we end chapter 11. Any questions about chapter 11 before I move on? All right, so as we begin chapter 12, we'll look at, like I mentioned, those three things. We'll see how James is martyred for his faith. We will also see how that will lead to the imprisonment of Peter. Once again, he will be in prison and then is rescued by an angel of God. And then finally, we will study how King Herod is struck dead by God for his vanity. So as we begin, we'll look at that first section, verses 1 through 5, and then we'll talk about this text as we go. So if you'll get out your Bibles, we'll go ahead and start there in verse number 1 and notice what the text says. In Acts 12 and verse 1, Luke records about the time that they're taking that benevolent offering down to Jerusalem. So he's referring back to what just happened as far as the giving that was offered. It's also about that time is when they're preparing for this famine to come upon the land as well. It says, about that time, Herod the king laid violent hands on some who belonged to the church. And so he introduces chapter 12 by talking about Herod, King Herod. Now, when we discuss King Herod, you may think, well, man, that guy's been around forever, hasn't he? Well, not really, but the name Herod has been around for a while. Herod is not what you call a proper name. It's more of a title. Herod refers to the individual that has been placed as ruler over Galilee, over the Galilean area, the Galilean part of Judea. That's why at the death of Jesus, you have the Jesus going both before Pilate and Herod, because Pilate and Herod were governing these two different areas. Pilate over the part of Jerusalem, the Jerusalem Judea part, Jerusalem part of Judea, I'm sorry. And then you had Herod over Galilee. And so Jesus would have really fallen under the jurisdiction from a Roman law perspective, under both men, because he was a Galilean, and yet he was a Jew who was working in Jerusalem at the time. And so you have Herod. Now, which Herod is this? We'll get into this more as we go, but Herod, this is Herod Agrippa the first. And there'll be another Herod Agrippa when you get to Acts 26. It's a different one, and we'll know why by the end of this chapter, why it can't be this guy. But this Herod, Herod Agrippa the first, is the grandson of Herod the Great. Anybody know who that is? You go back in your early New Testament history. This is the Herod who murdered the firstborn of Israel at the time of Jesus' birth. Very similar to what happened during the time of the Egyptian bondage when they killed the firstborn. When the angel of the Lord went through and killed the firstborn of the Egyptians. Well, this time it's kind of turned. And also going back to the time of Moses when they tried to kill the male children of Israel. Well, now, as Jesus' birth was approaching, you had Herod going through, or after his birth, killing all the firstborn, or all the children of the Israelites. Well, that was this guy's grandfather. He was also the nephew of Herod Antipas. So, not Herod Antipas wasn't the son of Herod the Great, but he was a nephew. Well, this Herod, Herod Agrippa I, is the nephew of that Herod. Now, I know you're probably thoroughly confused at this point. A lot of different individuals with similar sounding names. So you had Herod the Great, time of Jesus. He was followed by Herod Antipas, his nephew. And then he was followed by Herod the Great's grandson, Herod Antipas's nephew. And that's the Herod that's under discussion here. Herod Antipas, you may remember him, just to kind of note who he is, from Matthew 12 and Mark 6, both give us the details of the death of John the Immerser, John the Baptist. You remember he was beheaded. Why was he beheaded? Anybody recall that back in your memory banks? Studying Matthew 12, Mark 6. His illegitimate wife, her daughter, did a dance for Herod. Herod was pleased, and so he gave her whatever she wanted. Well, she talked to her mom. Her mom said, "I want the head of John the Baptist," and I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, but basically that's what happened. Then Herod beheaded John the Baptist. She hated his Herodias, his adulterous wife of his brother, hated John the Baptist because he condemned Herod and Herodias' marriage. And so she had great hatred for Herod. That was Herod Herod Antipas, the uncle of the Herod Agrippa we're talking about in chapter 12. And now this Herod Agrippa, reigned from about 42 to 44 A.D., You want to put this kind of in the time frame as we go through this chapter. The events of chapter 12 take place right around A.D. 44. That gets us pretty close to a specific time period when this is going on. And we'll see some other markers in this chapter that tell us, really identify the time of year it was even as we go on. But here is Herod Agrippa I. He brings violence against the church. Now, what we don't know is why. Why did he do this? Luke doesn't give us the precursor to this. But he does, however, give us why it continues. And we'll get to that in just a minute. But so he lays hands, violence against the church. What we also don't know is who else was involved. We know from verse number 2 that James, the apostle James, was one of those victims of his violence. And we'll know that Peter is going to be a victim of his violence. However, we don't know who else. There might have been other church members that suffered at his hand. We just don't know, because Luke doesn't record that for us, if there was anyone else. It says, verse 2, he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. Well, Luke gives us enough information to know exactly what James he's talking about. James, the brother of John. Well, you go back, there's a lot of passages. I don't have it up here, but Mark chapter 3 and verse 17, we know him as James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James. They're also noted as the sons of thunder. They were two fiery individuals, apparently, given by their nickname. Maybe also a reference to, they may have been redheaded. That was a name sometimes given to individuals who had red hair, sons of thunder. We also know about John that he was one of the two in Mark chapter 10, beginning verse 35, that asked Jesus to be at his right hand when he came into his kingdom. Their mother also asked that same thing. They were very close to Jesus. However, you remember in Mark chapter 10, Jesus' response to that. In verse number 38, Jesus, after they had asked to sit one at his right, one at his left, Jesus responded by saying, you do not know what you're asking, verse 38. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized? Now, I only bring that up is to relate it back to this. You know, Jesus, they come and they ask for seats of prominence in his kingdom. Of course, they misunderstand what the idea of the kingdom is. There's a lot under that. But what I find interesting is Jesus' response. He says, you don't know what you're asking for. What do you mean by that? Well, they don't really understand yet what Jesus is going to have to go through in order to establish the kingdom. They don't understand that he's going to have to suffer the way he's going to. He's going to have to be led to the cross the way he's going to. And they also don't understand what that means for them. As an apostle, as a disciple of Jesus, what did that mean for their lives? Are they going to live long, happy lives? Well, the only apostle who lived and died of natural causes is John. All the other apostles are noted as being martyred at one point or another. And so when Jesus says, you don't understand the cup that I'm having to drink, well, he's referring exactly to what happens here in Acts chapter 12. James, as we mentioned before, the timeline would put James being probably the first martyred apostle in AD 44. Can't say that conclusively, but it seems interesting to note that Luke would note these events here in chapter 12 and it not be the first time an apostle was martyred or murdered. So here you have a real change in dynamic. You know, you think about what happened to Stephen and how it's different than what happened here. Now both men, Stephen and James, are martyred for their faith. However, in the case with Stephen, is that happened out of anger. Those people were so angry, their anger overtook them, and they murdered him out of a rage. Here you just have simply cold-blooded murder. You have a man who's just trying to be a child of God, who isn't doing anything worthy of crime, or worthy of punishment, I'm sorry, no crime. And yet here he is just simply killed, beheaded, because he is a child of God. It also speaks to the wickedness of Herod and how corrupt of a politician he really was. We go on in chapter 12 and verse number 3. The text reads, and when he, Herod, saw that it pleased the Jews, speaking to, again, his vanity, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. This was during the days of unleavened bread. And when he had seized him, Peter, he, Herod, put him in prison, delivering him over to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending after the Passover to bring him out to the people. So he sees the reaction of the people and how pleased these Jewish leaders and the people are at hearing of the death of James. That's kind of really sad, isn't it? But they're happy, so he's happy. And so he says, I'm going to make the people even happier. I'm going to arrest and behead or slay in some way Peter. And so he finds Peter, he arrests him, and prepares to kill him. He doesn't kill him right away. He instead puts him under guard. It seems as though Herod was planning a big event to end Passover. Passover would last how long? 8 days. And so the thought may be that he was waiting until the eighth day to do this as kind of a climatic event to the week of Passover. Now, some translations will have the word Easter here. Of course, that is not a reference to what a lot of people in our country celebrate as Easter. Number one, these are Jews and Gentiles. They don't care anything about the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. These are people who are opposed to that. That word for Easter is the same word for Passover. It's just some versions, for some reason, translated that word to Easter. Of course, not referring to that. Resource that I was looking at said it's probably used there in some translations because it's a reference to this time of year it was, the season of the year, referring to a springtime time of the year. The text also tells us there were four guards or four squads of soldiers who were appointed to watch him. A total of 16 soldiers would have been used. He would have been watched around the clock with four guards at one time, and they would revolve around the clock. We'll get more into that in just a minute. Let's go into verse number 5, and then I'll ask if you have any questions. So here's Peter. He's in prison. He's been captured. You've already had James beheaded. What's the reaction of the church? Who in here would be pretty afraid? I'd be pretty afraid right now of what's going to happen next. They've got two of our biggest leaders in the church at the time, two of the men we look up to. Well, verse number 5 tells us, so Peter was kept in prison, but earnest prayer for him was made to God by the church. Now, the verb there for prayer, earnest prayer was made for him. The verb is in a present tense, indicating that this was a continual thing. That the indication may be that they were just, somebody was constantly praying for him. It's interesting to note their reliance on prayer in this moment. Now, what were they praying for? Don't know. Were they praying for his release? Maybe, but we don't know that. Were they just praying that God would protect him? Maybe. But whatever it was, they're offering that up to God on a continual basis in verse number 5. And so that leads us into the next section here, where Peter is freed from prison by an angel. Any questions about those first 5 verses? I'm moving through it kind of quick, I know. All right. We're good. We'll go on to verse number 6. Verse number 6, it says, now when Herod was about to bring him, Peter, out. So you get near the end of that Passover week. He's ready to have this big event in his mind. He probably thinks this is some kind of great way to really, you know, ignite the energy and the excitement of the people, that they'll praise him and he can win favor. Now, when Herod was about to bring him out, on that very night, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers bound with two chains, and sentries before the door were guarding the prison. So you have Peter under guard, like I said, by four men at all times. Two men would be literally chained to him, one on either side. And then you'd have two men posted at the door of the cell. I mean, they had every intention of making sure this individual would not be freed. Now, Peter's already been in prison before, hasn't he? Already been through that. And here he is again. He got out of that situation by simple flogging, and they let him go. This time, Herod has every intention of making sure he doesn't get out of this, in his mind, scot-free. He's going to behead him. And so here's Peter in a very desperate situation. Now, if you're Peter, you've just seen how James was beheaded. What kind of mindset are you in at this time? I mean, you're just praying, God, come on, right? How many of us are asking for forgiveness constantly just to make sure, right? You want to be prepared. God, if there's anything I've done, please, please forgive me. You want to be ready for that moment, because in his mind, I'm sure he feels like it's over. And maybe there's even a sense of relief in that. I don't know. But I'm sure there's also a high sense of terror over what awaits. And so is Peter here in this situation. We'll go on to verse number 7 and 8. We notice, so you have that situation, a very desperate, dire situation, a situation that seems inevitable, that he's going to die for his faith. That is, until God intervenes. And behold, an angel of the Lord stood next to him, and a light shone in the cell. He struck Peter, the angel, on the side and woke him, saying, "Get up quickly." And the chains fell off his hands. And the angel said to him, "Dress yourself and put on your sandals." And he did so. And he said to him, "Wrap a cloak around you and follow me." So here's Peter. He's sleeping. And I don't know what the other men were doing previous to this, whether they were awake or asleep. They're definitely asleep right now. They're out cold, all four of them. And Peter is just abruptly awoken out of that sleep by an angel of God. Now, back in Acts 5, the first time he's in prison, an angel was involved in that situation too. I want to go back there just real quickly. In Acts chapter 5 and verse number 17, God has used angels a variety of times to free his disciples. You notice in Acts 5 and verse 17, you recall there, the high priest rose up and all who were with him, that is the party of the Sadducees, and filled with jealousy, they arrested the apostles and put them in the public prison. But during the night, an angel of the Lord opened the prison doors and brought them out and said, "Go and stand in the temple and speak to the people all the words of this life." So the first time he's freed, the angel comes in, and I wonder, you know, you're Peter, what are you thinking about? Now, we're going to find out in a minute, he's still in Acts 12, thinks he's just seeing a vision. But he did have this event in Acts 5 to refer back to. And there the angel frees him from prison and says, "Go back to the temple and continue preaching." This time it's going to be a little bit different. But a very similar situation here in Acts 12. So God here has twice used angels to free Peter from prison. And so he does. He wraps himself in a cloak and he follows him. Now let's go to verse number 9 in Acts 12. Verse 9 says, "And he, Peter, went out and followed him, the angel. He did not know what was being done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision." So you see what I mean? Peter is in the state where, wow, This is a crazy dream, right? Or maybe God's showing me something that will happen in the future. Or, you know, however it is in his mind, he thinks he's seeing a vision or having a dream. And so that's where he is. Well, verse 10 goes on to tell us, when they had passed the first and second guard, they came to the iron gate leading into the city. It opened for them on its own accord. And they went out and went along one street. And immediately the angel left him. When Peter came to himself, he said, "Now I am sure that the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting." And so they walk out, and these doors are just opening up. Think about that for just a minute. And how amazing is all this that's going on? And here is Peter. He finally gets out in the street, and it's almost like the cold air woke him up. He's like, "Man, this is real." And so he knows now that God has freed him from the people. And we go on to verse number 12. I'm just reading through this. There's not a lot of extra detail I can add. I think it's good to read it. When he realized this wasn't a dream or a vision, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. And when he knocked at the door of the gateway, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. Recognizing Peter's voice, in her joy, she did not open the gate, but ran in and reported that Peter was standing at the gate. They said to her, "You're out of your mind." She kept insisting that it was so. And they kept saying, "It is his angel." But Peter continued knocking, and when they opened, they saw him and were amazed. This story always makes me chuckle. It may not affect you the same way. I'm just imagining, I'm picturing the girl here seeing Peter and just being so overwhelmed with shock that she just, you know, she runs back in and poor Peter's just still standing outside. And I'm sure he's sitting there wondering, okay, there's a guard going to come around that corner at any moment. You got to get me in here. But she's running inside. Now, he's come to the house of Mary. Now, what do we know about Mary? Well, Luke makes a connection between Mary and John Mark. Well, who is John Mark? Have we heard that name before? Well, go to Colossians chapter 4 and verse number 10. Somebody read Colossians 4 and verse 10, or I'll read it and y'all read along with me. Colossians 4 and verse 10. Articus, my fellow prisoner, greets you, and Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, concerning whom you have received instructions. If he comes to you, welcome him. Now, in Colossians 4, Paul is delivering his final remarks, and he's mentioning people, as he does often in his letters, he's mentioning people by name and giving certain requests or, you know, prayer requests or instructions in some way to the church he's writing to. Well, here he's writing to Colossians, and he makes mention of the cousin of Barnabas. Now, that Mark is this Mark in Acts 12, John Mark. Now, that word cousin is probably, I won't say definitively, probably better translated nephew. The word there used in the Greek seems to indicate sister's son. So that would make Mary the sister of Barnabas and John Mark the nephew of Barnabas. And so that would all make sense. Barnabas, we know, is from Jerusalem. We also know he was real prominent in the church. It'd be very likely that other members of his family were as well. And so you have Peter coming to this home of John Mark's mother, Mary. Now, John Mark's not there, and we'll find out why in just a minute as we get to the end of this chapter. But Mary is, and so is Miss Rhoda. She runs in. Now, Peter will also write about John Mark. I just mentioned this last one here. In 1 Peter 5 and verse 13, it's interesting how Peter refers to John Mark. In 1 Peter 5 and verse 13, Peter says, "She who is at Babylon, who is likewise chosen, sends you greetings, and so does Mark, my son." Now, that's probably not a reference to a biological son, but we've seen Paul use that same kind of language with Timothy and Titus. And usually, what are they talking about? Well, this is someone in the church, usually it's a younger man that they have brought into their ministry. They've been able to teach and work together. It denotes a very familial kind of relationship between the two. And so Peter obviously had a very close relationship with this Mark as well. Also, you might recognize that from the fact of where's the first place he goes when he gets out of prison? He goes to this home seeking refuge. And so there he is. Now, before we move off of this text, I want to speak just a second, and I don't have the time to get into a deep study about this. We did it during our study of angels. But in verse 15, when Rhoda keeps insisting that this is Peter, what's their last response there at the end of verse 15? Well, it's his angel. Some try to use this as a proof text for guardian angels. Well, is that what this is talking about? Is that what this is referring to? Now, when we think of the doctrine of guardian angels, what are we talking about? Again, I don't want to get into a deep dive about this just for lack of time, but guardian angels are said to be ministers of God who are chosen to protect a specific individual. Now, is that a biblical concept? I'm going to look at a couple texts to helpfully bring a little bit of light to this real quickly. Now, this is one passage that will be brought up. And number one, I want to note here, who's speaking? An inspired individual or just an individual? Now, I've noted this before. Is every statement in the Bible truthful? Yes, it's truthfully recorded. But is every statement in the Bible accurate or true or truth? Well, if you say yes to that, you're going to have a difficult time with Genesis 3. Because Satan is speaking there, and the words of Satan are recorded. Are Satan speaking truth or lies? Lies, right? So I'm not going to go to the words of Satan in Genesis 3 or in Matthew 4 as he's tempting Christ and say, well, see there, it's in the Bible, so it must be true. So it depends in our interpretation. We need to know who's talking. Now, these are Christians, but there's no indication they're speaking with the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. They could be speaking out of their own opinion. And so, number one, I want to note that just because it's said here doesn't make it a biblically accurate idea or doctrine. False doctrines are spoken by many people in Scripture. They're recorded truthfully. The statements are. That doesn't make the statement truth. Does that make sense? Any questions about that? So number one, that's number one. Number two, I will admit this is a difficult subject. And I want to note two passages why. But then I want to note some things behind it. Okay, go to Matthew 18 and verse number 10. I want you to notice there what Jesus says about children. In talking about harming children, he says, "See that you do not despise one of these little ones. For I tell you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven." Now, I'll be the first to admit I don't understand this completely. Maybe other people have a much better understanding of it. I don't know exactly what Jesus is saying. Number one, we know that as human beings, we don't turn into angels when we die. Now, we were watching a few weeks ago, It's a Wonderful Life. And it's a good movie. However, the idea that the angel gives to, the main character. I'm trying to think of the main character. Yeah, Jimmy Stewart's character. Anyway, the angel who comes to him seems to indicate that at one time he was a man living on earth, and now he's an angel. That's not biblical. We don't turn into angels when we die. Jesus says we'll be like the angels, but not angels themselves. Angels are a whole different created being by God. So number one, I want to note that. These little children, when he talks about their faces always... Their angels always see the face of God. He's not referring to, in some way, them becoming angels one day to see God. I do think he is talking about their innocence. Now, exactly what does he mean by this? Again, I'm not going to sit here and say I understand every aspect of this. However, I have an important question to say. Now, if the doctrine of guardian angels is true and that guardian angels protect us, and you have to ask the question, if that's true, why are children ever harmed? A lot of children are harmed in our world. If the doctrine of guardian angelship was true, there's a lot of angels who need to answer for their inability to protect these children. That's my first question. Now, exactly what's meant, again, I don't know exactly what Jesus is completely saying. I want to leave you one last passage. Go to Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 14. Now, angels do have a job to do. The Bible doesn't tell us everything they do. It hints at some things, and some things we just have no knowledge of. But I want you to notice what Hebrews 11:14 does say. Are they not all ministering spirits, talking about angels, sent out to serve for the sake of those who inherit salvation? Now, again, the Hebrews writer seems to be referring to some kind of work of angels in regard to the church. I don't know what that means. He doesn't really say anything else about it. So I wanted just to say that, I'm not trying to say I understand everything angels do, but the doctrine of guardian angels as given by some denominations is just simply not biblical, and it doesn't align with Scripture. So I wanted to mention that. You may have a question. Anybody have a question? Speak now or forever hold your peace. All right. For those online, I'm sorry I can't interact with you here. But you may have a question as well. You can ask those online, and I'll try my best to give you answers or point you to the direction you need to go. All right. So then I'll refer everybody back to, I did a series of lessons on angels where we dealt more in depth with these topics. So you can go online, go to our sermons, go back and look at that. I did a deep dive on all those topics. All right, let's go to Acts 12 and verse 17. Any questions up to this point? I'm out of time. So I guess we will end here. I encourage you, we still got a little bit there left to go too, so probably a good place to stop. Any other questions or comments? Go ahead and read the rest of the chapter. Go ahead and read chapter 13. Hopefully we'll get into chapter 13 next week as well. If not, we'll be ready to go the next week as we continue our study. Any questions? All right. Neil, would you mind leading us in prayer?